You are a stupid, stupid boy, Sembeba. There is never an excuse to shed blood without a very good reason. Now get out of my room. I'm sick of listening to you speak. You think I'm stupid for hating Tutsi's father? Don't you think it's more stupid to hide them? I hope you know that that's what people say you're doing. Is it true? Are you hiding Tutsi's in the house? My heart jumped into my mouth, and once again, all I felt was fear. I've had enough of your foolishness, Sembeba. I'm not hiding any Tutsis. And it pains me to hear your vindictive words. Your own mother was a Tutsi. I hope you know that your aunts, uncles, and all of your cousins are being hunted and killed. Now get out of my room and don't come back. Get out! We hadn't recovered from Simbeba's awful visit when we suddenly heard grenades exploding nearby. There were a series of terrific crashes that sounded like buildings collapsing. After each crash, we heard singing. Kill them big, kill them small, kill them, kill them, kill them all. There was gunfire near the house, and the singing got so loud that we knew the killers were moving in our direction. I said a silent prayer, and moments later, we heard a clap of thunder, followed by a heavy downpour of rain. I can only guess that the killers ran back to their homes to stay dry, because all we heard for the rest of the night was the rain pounding against the metal roof. That night, the pastor came to us. His face was pale, and his eyes were bloodshot and weary. I thought that he was worried about Sembeba's suspicions, but it was much worse. He'd been walking about outside and had witnessed the depth of the horror unfolding around us. He told us that the Interahamwe militiamen, soldiers, and Hutu civilians were destroying every Tutsi home they came across.
It is very bad outside, he said. Very, very bad. I saw the killings in 1959 and 1973, and they were nothing compared to this. You have to understand that everything else has stopped. The schools and markets are closed, and people aren't going to work. The country has been shut down until the job is done.
What do you mean, until the job is done? Until what job is done? I asked. The pastor paused.
Killing Tutsis. The job won't be done until all the Tutsis are dead. That's the government's main goal, and they're making everyone work very hard to achieve it.
I have seen things today that I wish I had never seen. My stomach twisted in a knot. I thought of my family, and I wanted to plug my ears and block out the pastor's voice.
They have killed thousands of people, he continued. Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, who knows? So many Tutsis ran into the churches for protection that the doors wouldn't close. Churches have always been off-limits for killing, but not this time. The killers burned the churches with the people still inside, and they shot anyone who tried to escape.
Oh, God, no, I said. On the radio, they told everyone to go to the churches and stadiums for protection.
They might have said that, but it wasn't to protect anyone. The killers were sent there with machine guns and grenades. The bodies are piled up as high as my house. The stench is unbearable.
Please, Pastor, enough! Don't say any more, I begged. I wanted to ask him for news of my family, but I didn't want to hear what he might say. I couldn't bear to hear another word.
I'm sorry to tell you these things, but you must know what's happening, he said. You may very well be the only Tutsis left alive in all of Rwanda. If you saw what I've seen today, I don't think you would want to live. The other ladies were crying, but not me. At that moment, I had no tears to shed. I didn't feel sorrow. I felt anger. I was angrier than I'd ever been before, more than I believed was even possible. I was angry at the pastor for telling us such horrific details when our families were out there with nowhere to hide. I was angry at the government for unleashing this Holocaust. I was angry at the rich countries for not stopping the slaughter. But most of all, I was angry at the Hutus, all of them. And as the pastor droned on about the horrible things being done to Tutsis, my anger grew into a deep, burning hatred. I'd never done anything violent to anyone before. But at that moment, I wished I had a gun so that I could kill every Hutu I saw. No, not a gun. I needed a machine gun, grenades, a flamethrower. I wanted to kill everyone, even Tutsis. I wanted to be like Rambo and set the whole country on fire. If I'd had an atomic bomb, I would have dropped it on Rwanda and killed everyone in our stupid, hateful land. I never would have believed that I would have had such capacity for rage. And I knew that I'd have to do a lot of praying to rid myself of it. Pastor Murinzi finished talking, and we just sat there, looking up at him and waiting for more horrible news. It would have been kinder if he'd picked up a whip and beaten us to death. I couldn't accept his words without confirmation. As he left, I asked him to turn on the radio in his room so that we could listen to news reports. He agreed and shut the door. A few minutes later, we heard a government minister speaking on the national radio station. I am appealing to all Hutus in Rwanda. It's time to stand together to fight our common enemy. These Tutsi snakes are trying to kill us. We must kill them first. Kill the Tutsis wherever you find them. Don't spare a single one. Kill the very old and kill the babies. They're all snakes. I urge all Hutus to do your duty and kill all our Tutsi enemies. Now I knew for certain that the pastor hadn't been lying. There is a culture of obedience in Rwanda, and I knew that when many otherwise peaceful Hutus heard their leaders on the radio telling them to kill Tutsis, they dutifully pick up their machetes. About an hour later, the pastor tuned in to the BBC News, and we heard a report saying that the RPF, the Tutsi rebel soldiers, had successfully fought their way from the far north of the country down to the capital, Kigali. The report said that the extremist Hutu government behind the genocide was in danger of collapsing. That news made our hearts leap. If the RPF reached Kigali, they should be able to fight their way south to our province in a few weeks. Sooner or later, they'd reach our little village and rescue us. I just hope that it was sooner, as later would probably be too late for us. Chapter 11, Struggling to Forgive. I was deep in prayer when the killers came to search the house a second time. It was past noon, and I'd been praying the rosary since dawn for God to give his love and forgiveness to all the sinners in the world. But try as I might, I couldn't bring myself to pray for the killers. That was a problem for me, because I knew that God expected us to pray for everyone, and more than anything, I wanted God on my side. As a compromise, I prayed the rosary multiple times as intensely as I could every day. Working through all those Hail Marys and Our Fathers took 12 or 13 hours, and whenever I reached the part of the Lord's Prayer that calls us to forgive those who trespassed against us, I tried not to think of the killers because I knew that I couldn't forgive them. During that second search, the killer's racket reached the edge of my prayers like an angry voice waking me from a dream. Then I heard 4 or 5 loud bangs next to my head, and they had my full attention. I realized that they were right there in the pastor's bedroom. They were rummaging through his belongings, ripping things from the wall, lifting up the bed, and overturning chairs. "Look in that," one of them yelled. "Now, look under here. Move that chest. Search everything." I covered my mouth with my hands, fearing that they'd hear me breathing. They were only inches from my head. They were in front of the wardrobe. The wardrobe. I thanked God again for it, but my heart still thumped against my chest. I could hear them laughing. They were having fun while going about killing people. I cursed them, wishing that they'd burn in hell. The wardrobe banged against the door. I covered my ears and prayed. "God, please. You put the wardrobe there. Now keep it there. Don't let them move it. Save us, Lord." My scalp was burning, and the ugly whispering slithered in my head again. "Why are you calling on God? Don't you have as much hatred in your heart as the killers do? Aren't you as guilty of hatred as they are? You've wished them dead. In fact, you wish that you could kill them yourself. You even prayed that God would make them suffer and make them burn in hell." I could hear the killers on the other side of the door and entreated, "God, make them go away." "Don't call on God, Immaculée," the voice broke in. "He knows that you're a liar. You lie every time you pray to him to say that you love him. Didn't God create us all in his image? How can you love God but hate so many of his creations?" My thoughts were paralyzed. I knew that the demon in my head was right. I was lying to God every time I prayed to him. I was so overwhelmed with hatred for the people responsible for the genocide that I had a hard time breathing. At least 40 or 50 men were in the pastor's bedroom by this time, and they were shouting and jeering. They sounded drunk and mean, and their chanting was more vicious than usual. "Kill the Tutsis, big and small. Kill them one and kill them all. Kill them!" I began praying, asking God to keep them away from the wardrobe and out of the house altogether. Beneath the raucous singing, the dark voice taunted me. "It's no use. Don't call on God. Who do you think sent the killers here for you?" "He did. Nothing can save you. God doesn't save liars." I began to pray for the killers and then stopped. I desperately wanted God's protection, but I believed in my heart that they deserved to die. I couldn't pretend that they hadn't slaughtered and raped thousands of people. I couldn't ignore the awful, evil things that they'd done to so many innocent souls. "Why do you expect the impossible from me?" I asked God. "How can I forgive people who are trying to kill me? People who may have already slaughtered my family and friends? It isn't logical. Let me pray for their victims instead, for those who've been raped and murdered and mutilated. Let me pray for the orphans and widows. Let me pray for justice. God, I will ask you to punish those wicked men, but I cannot forgive them. I just can't." Finally, I heard the killers leaving. First, they left the bedroom, then the house, and soon they were walking away down the road. Their singing faded in the distance. I resumed my prayers. I thanked God for saving us and for giving me the idea to put the wardrobe in front of the bathroom door. I wondered where the killers were off to. Then I started praying for my friends and family. Please look over my mother, God. She worries so much about us. Watch over my father. He can be so stubborn. It was no use. My prayers felt hollow. A war had started in my soul, and I could no longer pray to a God of love with a heart full of hatred. I tried again, praying for him to forgive the killers, but deep down I couldn't believe that they deserved it at all. It tormented me. I tried to pray for them myself, but I felt like I was praying for the devil. Please open my heart, Lord, and show me how to forgive. I'm not strong enough to squash my hatred. They've wronged us all so much. My hatred is so heavy that it could crush me. Touch my heart, Lord, and show me how to forgive. I struggled with the dilemma for hours on end. I prayed late into the night, all through the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. I prayed all week, scarcely taking food or water. I couldn't remember when or for how long I'd slept, and was only vaguely aware of time passing. One night I heard screaming not far from the house, and then a baby crying. The killers must have slain the mother and left her infant to die in the road. The child wailed all night. By morning, its cries were feeble and sporadic, and by nightfall, it was silent. I heard dogs snarling nearby and shivered to think how that baby's life had ended. I prayed for God to receive the child's innocent soul and then asked him, "How can I forgive people who would do such a thing to an infant?" I heard his answer as clearly as if we'd been sitting in the same room chatting. "You are all my children, and the baby is with me now." It was such a simple sentence, but it was the answer to the prayers I'd been lost in for days. The killers were like children. Yes, they were barbaric creatures who would have to be punished severely for their actions, but they were still children. They were cruel, vicious, and dangerous, as kids sometimes can be, but nevertheless, they were children. They saw but didn't understand the terrible harm they'd inflicted. They'd blindly hurt others without thinking. They'd hurt their Tutsi brothers and sisters. They'd hurt God, and they didn't understand how badly they were hurting themselves. Their minds had been infected with the evil that had spread across the country, but their souls weren't evil. Despite their atrocities, they were children of God, and I could forgive a child, although it would not be easy, especially when that child was trying to kill me. In God's eyes, the killers were part of his family, deserving of love and forgiveness. I knew that I couldn't ask God to love me if I were unwilling to love his children. At that moment, I prayed for the killers, for their sins to be forgiven. I prayed that God would lead them to recognize the horrific error of their ways before their life on earth ended, before they were called to account for their mortal sins. I held on to my father's rosary and asked God to help me, and again I heard his voice. "Forgive them. They know not what they do." I took a crucial step toward forgiving the killers that day. My anger was draining from me. I'd opened my heart to God, and he touched it with his infinite love. For the first time, I pitied the killers. I asked God to forgive their sins and turn their souls toward his beautiful light. That night, I prayed with a clear conscience and a clean heart. For the first time since I entered the bathroom, I slept in peace. Chapter 12, No Friends to Turn To. I found a place in the bathroom to call my own, a small corner of my heart. I retreated there as soon as I awoke and stayed there until I slept. It was my sacred garden, where I spoke with God, meditated on His words, and nurtured my spiritual self. When I meditated, I touched the source of my faith and strengthened the core of my soul. While horror swirled around me, I found refuge in a world that became more welcoming and wonderful with each visit. Even as my body shriveled, my soul was nourished through my deepening relationship with God. I entered my special space through prayer. Once inside, I prayed nonstop, using my rosary as an anchor to focus my thoughts and energies on God. The rosary beads helped me concentrate on the Gospels and keep the words of God alive in my mind. I prayed in silence, but always mouthed the words to convince myself that I was really saying them. Otherwise, doubt would creep in and the negative energy would come calling. I spent hours contemplating the meaning of a single word, such as forgiveness, faith, or hope. I spent days with the word surrender, and I came to understand what it meant to surrender oneself to a higher power. I gave myself over completely to God. When I wasn't praying, I felt that I was no longer living in His light, and the world of the bathroom was too bleak to endure. Toward the end of our first month in hiding, Pastor Morenzi came to us late one night with a plate of scraps. He'd acted with compassion when he took us in, but that seemed to be waning. On this night, his face was set in a scowl instead of its usual expression of concern and pity.
"Your father was a very bad Tutsi," he snapped at me.
"He was helping the RPF rebels plan a civil war." He looked at the other ladies, pointed at me, and said, "If they catch you and kill you, it will be because of Immaculée. The killers are hunting her because of her father's activities." He was glaring at me, and I could feel the eyes of the other women on me. "They found 600 guns in your house," he continued, turning back to me. "They also found grenades and a death list of Hutu names. That's the reason you Tutsis are being hunted and killed. If Hutus hadn't acted first, we'd be the ones being killed by Tutsis now." I couldn't believe what he was saying. The poisoned lies that the extremist Hutus were spreading had robbed Pastor Morenzi of his reason. He'd been friends with my father for years and knew that he dedicated himself to improving the lives of the poor and less fortunate. Hadn't my father even urged the desperate Tutsi refugees at our house not to kill Hutus, even if the Hutus were trying to kill them? Pastor Morenzi told me that he'd gotten his information from the authorities. Unfortunately, like so many other Rwandans, he blindly believed what he was told by people in power. I was so angry with the pastor that I wanted to scream. But how could I do anything? He was all that stood between us and death. We were completely dependent upon his charity, even if he wasn't being very charitable at the moment. Now he viewed us the way the killers did, as non-humans, cockroaches that were destined to be exterminated before the war was over. My anger boiled inside me as Pastor Morenzi abused my father's good name. I raised my voice for the first time since he'd locked us away in the bathroom. If my father had so many guns, why didn't he pass them out to the thousands of Tutsis who came to us looking for protection when they burned our house to the ground? If he'd planned to kill Hutus, he would have killed them before they destroyed his life. Tell me, Pastor, why didn't he use the guns to protect his wife and daughter from killers and rapists? Pastor Morenzi was shocked by my outburst, and so were the ladies, their eyes open wide in disbelief as they watched me challenge the man who held their lives in his hands. He waved at me to be quiet. The pastor's claims were such obvious lies, I had to challenge him. "Did you see any of these weapons, Pastor?"
No, but I heard about them from important people. They're honest and wouldn't lie.
I couldn't believe that it was possible for an educated man to be so naive, especially with what was happening in the country.
So, you have no proof of the things you accuse my father of?
He took a blank piece of paper out of his pocket and said that it was the type of paper RPF rebels gave to people who donated guns and money.
It was found at your house, he said, waving it in front of me as if he were holding a smoking gun.
It's just a blank piece of paper.
But it's the kind of blank paper that the rebels use.
I couldn't stand talking to him anymore.
Well, if that's the kind of evidence you use to condemn a man, then I can understand why killing comes so easily to people around here.
The pastor stuffed the little piece of paper back into his pocket and turned to leave.
Wait, I called to him.
Do you have a Bible you could lend me? I forgot mine at home. He seemed embarrassed. He knew my home was a charred ruin and agreed to bring me one. I was grateful. I needed to cleanse my mind with God's beautiful words. The other ladies looked at me as though I'd lost my senses. They thought that I'd needlessly, recklessly challenged the pastor's patience and authority. Maybe I had, but I didn't care. I felt obligated to defend my father, and at that moment, the pastor seemed more like a jailer than a savior. Besides, the fact that Pastor Morinzi felt comfortable speaking ill of Dad was a pretty good indication that he thought our days were numbered. Rwandans are intensely private and secretive people who keep their emotions to themselves. The pastor would never have bared his feelings to me if he thought that I would survive the Holocaust and meet him again one day as an equal. I was praying to rid myself of my negative anger when Pastor Morinzi turned on the radio in his bedroom. The new president of Rwanda was speaking, and our ears perked up when we heard him say the name of our home province, Kibuye. His voice was exuberant. Could it be the war was over? Would we finally be able to leave the bathroom and go find our families? The six of us looked at each other eagerly, thinking that we were going to hear some good news at last. But our hopes were smashed as we listened in horror.
I want to personally congratulate the hard-working Hutus of Kibuye for their excellent work, the president said. More of our Tutsi enemies have been killed in Kibuye than in any other province.
I felt sick. Did the world not see the madness that had seized this country? Was no one going to come and help us? The president was so pleased with the good work being done in Kibuye that he promised to send thousands of dollars to buy food and beer so that the killers could celebrate properly.
You have been doing fine work in Kibuye. Almost all our enemies are dead. But we must kill them all. Let's finish the job.
We looked at each other in despair. Could he really mean that almost all the Tutsis in our area were dead? There were more than 250,000 Tutsis in Kibuye. How could this be? What about our families? I asked God if he was testing me, and once again, I put my hands together to pray. Yet it was difficult to find my quiet place to talk to God while the devil was screaming in my ears. Another report came across the pastor's radio. This one announced the death of hundreds of students on my campus. It was a massacre.
We have killed more than 500 snakes and their Hutu traitor friends at the university, the announcer bragged.
It pained me to think of all my university friends, many of whom had been close friends since high school. I knew for certain that a lot of them had stayed on campus over the Easter holiday. I thought about all those lovely girls that I'd laughed with, cried with, and prayed with. And all the dreams we shared about growing up, falling in love, and having families. We were sure that we'd be friends for life. Now their lives were over, extinguished. I prayed that they hadn't been tortured. My heart ached. Had I lost everyone I'd ever loved? I closed my eyes and prayed for God to show me a sign that He was with me. He was the only one I had left, the one I could trust. Then I once again asked Him for a sign that He was watching over us. The pastor opened the door and, without saying a word, handed me the Bible I'd asked for earlier. I opened it immediately and looked down at Psalm 91. He alone is my refuge, my place of safety. He is my God, and I am trusting Him. For He rescues you from every trap and protects you from the fatal plague. He will shield you with His wings. His faithful promises are your armor. Now, you don't need to be afraid of the dark anymore, nor fear the dangers of the day. Though 1,000 fall at my side, though 10,000 are dying around me, the evil will not touch me. Chapter 13, A Gathering of Orphans. More than a month passed, and we thought we'd never see the sky again. The killers came and went as they pleased, arriving unannounced at the pastor's door at all hours of the day or night. We knew that they'd keep on coming until they found us, or until they lost the war. The news reports on the pastor's radio were bleak. Government leaders had turned every single Rwandan radio station into a propaganda death machine. The announcers told Hutus everywhere that it was their duty to kill Tutsis on sight, no questions asked. And the country was still completely shut down to ensure that work didn't interfere with killing. It seemed that every Hutu in Rwanda had a gun or machete, along with orders to use them on Tutsis, and no one in the world was lifting a finger to stop them. We knew from radio reports that help was not on its way, and I couldn't understand how other countries, especially the so-called civilized ones in the West, could turn their backs on us. They knew that we were being massacred, yet they did nothing. The UN had even withdrawn its peacekeeping force shortly after the killing began. However, Roméo Dallaire, the Canadian general in charge of the UN peacekeepers, refused to obey his orders to leave and remained with a couple hundred soldiers. He was a brave and moral man, but he was also alone in a sea of killers. We heard him often on the radio begging for someone, anyone, to send troops to Rwanda and stop the slaughter, but no one listened to him. Belgium, our country's former colonial ruler, had been the first to pull its soldiers out of the country. Meanwhile, the United States wouldn't even acknowledge that the genocide was happening. It was impossible for them not to know that our politicians wouldn't stop the killing until every Tutsi man, woman, and child was dead. Anybody could hear what they planned to do, what they were doing, by tuning in to any radio station. Sometimes, the pastor would tell us details of the official genocide plans that weren't included in the radio broadcasts. Once the Tutsis are all dead, they're going to make it look like they never existed. They will erase every trace of them, he told us matter-of-factly. As the war dragged on, the pastor became increasingly worried about what he was going to do with us. If the fighting lasts many months more, I'll run out of food to feed you. It will be impossible for me to keep you, he fretted. I wondered what he planned to do when the food ran out. I couldn't allow myself to believe that he'd turn into a killer, not after risking his life to save us. I certainly knew that he was capable of kicking us out of the house. I also knew that the countryside was crawling with killers and that we wouldn't last an hour outside of the bathroom. The pastor must have thought a lot about it, and finally, he decided that he needed God's help. One night, he asked us to pray with him that God would help the government soldiers win the war. We just looked at him. Didn't he realize what he was asking us to do? I couldn't believe how insensitive he'd become to our suffering. Nevertheless, we were in a tight spot. What else could we do? We all put our hands together and pretended to pray with him. What I actually prayed for were the souls of the thousands and thousands of Tutsis who had already been murdered. Then I prayed for the killers to come into God's powerful light and be changed by his love. Touch them with your divine love, God. Only then will they drop their machetes and fall to their knees. Please, God, move them to stop their slaughter. Forgive them. If the Hutu extremists finished what they started, we'd be the last living Tutsis in Rwanda. We'd be orphans in a hostile homeland. But I didn't feel like an orphan at all. I'd been praying continually for weeks, and my relationship with God was deeper than I'd ever imagined possible. I felt like the daughter of the kindest, most powerful king the world had ever known. I surrendered my thoughts to God every day when I retreated to that special place in my heart to communicate with him. That place was like a little slice of heaven where my heart spoke to his Holy Spirit and his spirit spoke to my heart. He assured me that while I lived in his spirit, I'd never be abandoned, never be alone, and never be harmed. I sat stone still on that dirty floor for hours on end, contemplating the purity of his energy, while the force of his love flowed through me like a sacred river, cleansing my soul and easing my mind. Sometimes I felt as though I were floating above my body, cradled in God's mighty palm, safe in his loving hand. In my mind, I heard myself speaking in exotic languages I'd never heard before. I instinctively knew that I was praising God's greatness and love. During my waking hours, I was in constant communication with God, praying and meditating for 15 to 20 hours every day. I even dreamed of Jesus and the Virgin Mary during the few hours I slept. In the midst of the genocide, I found my salvation. I knew that my bond with God would transcend the bathroom, the war, and the Holocaust. It was a bond I now knew would transcend life itself. I lifted my heart to the Lord, and he filled it with his love and forgiveness. Being in that bathroom had become a blessing for which I'd be forever thankful. Even if my parents had perished in the bloodshed outside, I would never be an orphan. I'd been born again in the bathroom and was now the loving daughter of God, my father. Late one night in the middle of May, the bathroom door flew open. Suddenly, two young Interahamwe killers towered above us. We flinched, expecting a machete blow at any second, but then we heard the pastor's voice whispering that we should sit still and not worry. A moment later, we realized that the figures weren't killers at all, but two Tutsi women desperate to join our hidden sorority. We were happy to see two other living, breathing Tutsis, but we couldn't find a place for them to sit. The pastor shoved them into the room, and they fell on top of us. "Don't make any noise," he reminded us again and closed the door. The girls' faces were just visible in the dim light seeping through the window. We risked a few minutes of hushed conversation to find out where they'd come from and what was happening in the outside world. Their names were Malaba and Solange. Malaba was about my age. I'd seen her a couple of times while growing up, but didn't know her well, and Solange was a teenager whom I'd never met before. Unbeknownst to us, Marianne, one of the pastor's elder daughters, had been hiding the two girls at her home in northern Rwanda since the genocide had started.
Marianne had a reputation for being kind and compassionate, which made her highly suspicious in the eyes of the extremists. Her house had been searched several times, and she feared that sooner or later, Malaba and Solange would be discovered. Somehow, Marianne managed to obtain a fake identity card for Malaba and disguised both of them in costumes similar to the ones the killers liked to wear. She put the machetes, guns, and hand grenades that the Interahamwe had given her to kill Tutsis into her car and seated the girls beside the weapons. Then, as the fighting raged all around them, they began the long, dangerous drive south to her dad's house, where she hoped they'd all find safety. Malaba and Solange told us that every few miles, Interahamwe killers would stop them at roadblocks and ask for their identity cards. Because Solange didn't have a card, the women thought they'd be killed at every stop. Having no identity card was as bad as having a Tutsi one, which was a death sentence.
"One man handed them his Tutsi card, and they chopped his head off right in front of us,"
Solange whispered, shaking her head, unable to believe what she'd witnessed with her own eyes.
"They even killed Hutus who had forgotten their identity cards at home," Malaba said. "I recognize one of the men they killed. I knew he was a Hutu, but they didn't. He was a little taller than they were. That's all it took. They called him a Tutsi spy and shot him. Then they killed another Hutu because he said that it was wrong for them to be killing Tutsis."
Before they began their journey, Marianne told the girls that they'd better be able to act like killers if they wanted to survive. So every time they were pulled over at a roadblock, they picked up a machete or gun and shook it in the air.
"We scream like crazy women," Solange said. "We'd shout, 'Hutu power! Hutu power! Kill all the cockroaches! Kill those Tutsi dogs!' The killers love seeing us act like that. They tell us to keep up the good work and wave us through. Wanting to kill Tutsis is like having a passport. The country has gone mad."
The two sisters told us that they'd passed so many dead bodies on the road heading south that it took them a long time to realize that they were seeing corpses.
"There were so many, and they were stacked so high that we thought we were passing by piles of old clothes and garbage. But when we looked closer, when we stopped and rolled down the window, we knew. You could hear the buzz of the flies over the sound of the car engine. And there were hundreds of dogs eating the bodies, fighting over the body parts. It's all so sickening. The whole country reeks of rotting flesh," Solange said. Her face was pale and she trembled as she spoke. "I can't get those images out of my head. Even when I close my eyes, all I see are dead bodies."
We heard similar horror stories on the radio and from the pastor. It sounded like the apocalypse had arrived, and Rwanda was the first stop. Malaba was weeping as she adjusted her position in our laps.
"If Marianne hadn't taken us in, we'd be lying in one of those piles of corpses, being eaten by dogs."
The image made me shiver. I wondered for the millionth time where my parents and brothers were, and silently asked God to watch out for them.
"You're the only family I can talk to now, God. I'm relying on you to take care of the others."
It was much more crowded than usual in the bathroom that night. I drifted off to sleep shortly before dawn and had the most intense dream of my life. I saw Jesus standing in front of me, his arms outstretched as though he were about to embrace me. He was wearing a piece of cloth wrapped around his waist, and his long hair spilled down around his shoulders. I remember being struck by how thin he looked. His ribs protruded, and his cheeks were lean and hollow.
yet his eyes sparkled like stars when he looked at me, and his voice was as soft as a gentle breeze. When you leave this room, you will find that almost everyone you know and love is dead and gone, he said. I am here to tell you not to fear. You will not be alone. I will be with you. I will be your family. Be at peace and trust in me, for I will always be at your side. Don't mourn too long for your family, Immaculée. They are with me now, and they have joy. I awoke relaxed and happy. Dreaming of Jesus was a beautiful treat, and I relished the warm afterglow, thanking God for sending me such wonderful thoughts. But as the day wore on, my heart became heavy. Jesus had said that my family was dead, and I desperately wanted them to be alive. I wanted to see my parents, tell Vianney how sorry I was for letting him go that night, and watch Damascene's smile spread across his face. After all my prayers, why couldn't God spare their lives? I closed my eyes and comforted myself, thinking that if it were only a dream, my family could very well be alive. And if it hadn't been a dream, then God had promised to care for me always, and I'd never known God to break a promise. Not long after that dream, I heard people talking outside the bathroom window about some recent killings they'd witnessed. One of the men chose to tell the story of the capture of a young man who'd been hiding in the area since the beginning of the war. This boy had a master's degree from university, and the killers kept taunting him about it. They'd asked him why they'd caught him if he was so smart. One of them said he wanted to see the brains of someone with a master's degree, so he chopped the boy across the head with his machete. Then he looked inside the skull. My heart broke. There were not that many young Tutsi men in the area who earned a master's degree. I was sure that they were talking about my brother, Damascene. Oh, God, please don't let it be him, I prayed. I tried to calm down, telling myself that I couldn't be certain they were talking about Damascene. I kept praying that it wasn't my brother and waited for Pastor Morinzi to come with our food. When he finally opened the door hours later, I told him what I'd heard and asked him, point blank, if the people had been talking about Damascene's murder. I'd surprised him with my question and noticed that his eyes wouldn't meet mine. No, not at all, he said. They've been killing many young men, so there's no reason to think that they meant your brother. I haven't heard anything about your brothers, Immaculée. The expression on his face told me that Damascene was dead. But how could I be sure? I bit my lip and thanked him for keeping me informed and for protecting all of us. He nodded and left in a big hurry. The other women told me not to worry, that my brother was all right, and that there was no way of knowing whom the men had been talking about. I smiled a little, outwardly agreeing with them. But my heart wouldn't listen to my head. I began weeping, softly at first, but soon I was sobbing inconsolably. I slapped my face and pinched myself hard all over, hoping that the pain would distract me and stop my tears. But nothing worked. I knew that the other women were panicking, afraid that I'd be overheard, but I couldn't stop myself. I bit my hand to stifle my crying, but the tears kept pouring down my face and my sobbing grew louder. To make matters worse, the younger girls began crying too. The older ladies were waving their hands in the air, silently begging me to stop my bawling. An hour later, I did stop, and I never cried in that bathroom again. Chapter 14,
the gift of tongues. 7 weeks in the bathroom had left us all frighteningly gaunt, our bones pushed into our flesh and our skin sagged. Sitting on the hard floor became increasingly uncomfortable as our muscle and fat disappeared, leaving us with no padding on our bottoms. Despite having two additional women with us, the bathroom grew roomier every day. We were shrinking, and our starvation diet left us weak and lightheaded much of the time. I could tell by my clothes that I'd lost at least 40 pounds, and I was only about 115 pounds to begin with. Our skin was pale, our lips were cracked, and our gums were swollen and sore. To make matters worse, since we hadn't showered or changed clothes since we'd arrived, we were plagued by a vicious infestation of body lice. Sometimes the tiny bugs grew so engorged with our blood that we could see them marching across our faces. We may not have been a pretty sight, but I'd never felt more beautiful. Each day I awoke and thanked God for giving me life, and each morning he made me feel loved and cherished. I knew that he hadn't kept me alive so long and through so much suffering just to let me be killed beneath the machete of a blood-drunk killer. And I knew that he wouldn't let me die from some silly everyday ailment. I was sick twice in the bathroom with illnesses that I could have taken care of in a day with a couple of pills, if we'd had any. The first sickness came with a 105-degree fever that left me shaking and delirious. The second was a nasty urinary tract infection, which was one of the most painful experiences I've ever endured. The only thing the pastor had to offer me was a thermometer and his best wishes. He had no medication to spare. All I could do was pray, so that's what I did.